This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Thanksgiving, many Americans will be returning to their hometowns for family reunions. We're going to talk with Ken Wells about the place where he grew up, the Louisiana Bayou. As a senior writer and features editor for Page One of the Wall Street Journal, Ken Wells collects stories about interesting and unusual people. His own story, growing up on the bayou, surrounded by more snakes and alligators than neighbors, is the basis of his two novels. His first novel, Mealy LeBove, is about a 15-year-old living on the bayou with his father, an alligator hunter who drinks a lot, often leaving Mealy to fend for himself. The kid who bullies Mealy, Junior Guidry, is the main character in Ken Wells' new novel, Junior's Leg. Set 12 years later, Junior is now a drunk, broke, ex-oil rig worker with a wooden leg. He lost his leg in an accident, boarding a rig in the shark-infested Gulf. Here's a reading in which Junior tells that story. I'll let Ken Wells introduce it.
This picks up with Junior basically being hung over, as Junior often is, and he's going off on his offshore shift where they work 7 and 7. It's pitching rough out there. The Gulf is a big mess, and of course, he's going to work with his arch enemy, a guy named Armitage that he hates and who hates him. And of course, Armitage has just basically called him a sissy if he doesn't want to get up on that rig. And of course, Junior, being Junior, would never abide that. So he's going up one way or the other. I slam into the ladder, and I know I busted my left wrist good, but I grab onto a rung with my right hand, and I'm on the damn thing, even if it weren't Purdy. I steady myself and reach up for the next rung. I don't even see the boat pitching my way on a big swell. I've got my right leg up on the next rung, but the crew boat pitches forward and bashes into the ladder, and there's a sound like the devil's sawing on a tin roof. The bow catches my leg, and I hear every damn bone crack. I know my knee's been crushed like a bull redfish crushes a blue crab before it swallows it whole. The crew boat pitches down and rises up again, and I think the monster's just going to wipe me off the ladder like a mosquito slapped off the wall. But it misses me the second time and scrapes up against the fender of the rig, and I'm hanging there by one arm like a baboon, and some bastard is yelling, and the boat roars and finally backs away. A cloud of diesel comes blowing in my face. It's a damn good thing I'm as strong as I am. I'm hanging on, and I'm looking down at the water. I see something floating down there. The Gulf is rough and gray. Rough and gray as the sky, and then it's gray and red. There's a fire hose spraying red, and then I goddamn do know what I see down there. It's my leg.
Why did you want to start a novel with a grisly accident like this?
Well, first of all, grisly accidents like this happen down in the oil patch in Louisiana. You know, it's, you know, danger is a fact of life. Those jobs are really well paid, and they're often very sought after. But, you know, things like this unfortunately do happen. I also, you know, Junior obviously is a follow-up novel to my earlier novel about, you know, Mealy, a kid that Junior bullied. And so, you know, this is 12 years later, and in a way, Junior is getting his comeuppance. You know, he's been a bad guy all of his life, and he's been a bully all of his life, and now he's being brought down a notch or two.
Yeah, so you took the character who was the bad guy from your first novel, the kid who bullied the main character, and you made this bully the main character of your second novel. Did you have to start seeing him in a more sympathetic light in order to frame a whole book around him?
Well, the idea all along was to try to save Junior from his sorry self, you know, and I think, you know, the whole notion of redemption runs through this book, and I just thought it would be interesting to try to take the bad guy and make something of him. Some of this is mildly autobiographical, too. You know, I cut my teeth as a cub reporter on the little paper down in Louisiana at around the time that Junior would have come of age, and every kid in high school, every boy in high school that I knew when I graduated in 1966 who wasn't going to college was going off to work the oil patch. And it was like going to the mines. You know, everyone did it. Everyone knew it was dangerous, dirty work. And yet there's a lot of money to be made. And kids coming out of high school were making $20,000 a year at some risk, of course. And so it just occurred to me that this is exactly where Junior would have ended up. And it was a way also of writing about that time and those issues.
So tell me more about the presence of oil in your world when you were growing up.
Well, I grew up in this little tiny place called Bayou Black, Louisiana, and it was a, you know, sort of Cajun enclave of about 200 families. everybody of my mother's generation spoke French, and certainly my grandmother's generation spoke nothing but French. Oil came in kind of early, but not really take off until the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where there was these sort of boom and bust cycles. And there's no doubt that it brought unparalleled, economic prosperity to the place, but it also changed it eradicably in ways that, it still is not, in my opinion, recovered from.
Reading your novels, they seem to be set in a different country. The novels even have glossaries in the back for Cajun terms that we might not know either what they mean or how to pronounce them.
Well, there are a lot of people who say politically Louisiana is a third world nation. I love the place, first of all. But it is bedeviling in many ways. And one of the ways that it's bedeviling is that there is no sense of how we ought to deal with change and growth and economic development and oil. So as a result, there was this massive industry that came in and was able, in part through complicity, political complicity in Louisiana, to totally change the environmental landscape and the social landscape. And it really, in many ways, sort of rent the fabric of the community. I mean, Bayou Black, when I moved out there in 1957, I would say was a place that had not changed much in 200 years. I mean, Southdown Sugars, my dad worked for a sugar mill when he wasn't hunting alligators, and they still had a mule lot. They didn't totally trust the tractor in 1957. And by 1975, because of growth and prosperity brought by oil, there were subdivisions basically lapping at our farmstead out there, and it started to look like every other place in the world. So, it definitely has left a mark in the place.
Would you physically describe Bayou Black when you were growing up?
Well, imagine a small town spread out, along the opposing banks of a bayou that runs about 12 miles. The bayous basically were the distributaries of the mighty Mississippi River in that part of our state. And they took runoff, and of course, as they flooded, they built levees. And the floodwaters, Cajuns who came down there, settled those bayous in the late 1700s, always built their homes along the bayou bank because that was the high ground. So basically, the bayous are simply communities stretched out along opposing bayou banks. And it didn't matter if you lived at one end of the bayou or the other end of the bayou. Basically, everybody started working for the oil industry, people were mainly farmers or they were fishermen or they were trappers. We lived next a mile or two away from Alligator Annie, who was a Cajun woman who ran had a bayou-side menagerie where she sort of collected swamp critters and showed them to tourists for a couple dollars and sold stuff to zoos. And there were six sons in my family, and my father, who had come from the swamps of Arkansas, immediately signed us up with Annie, and we started collecting snakes for her. And so I spent, instead of working in the 7-Eleven during my formative years, I was out tromping the fields. My Cajun grandmother was superstitious, and she was so opposed. See, my father was not a man of the Catholic faith, and all Cajuns are Catholic, so it was already a tragedy that, my mother had married out of her faith. But now her grandsons were trafficking in a serpent. I mean, this was considered to be totally blasphemous. So one day when my dad was away at the sugar mill, seriously, my grandmother shows up with my uncle and my mother lines us all up on the front porch of our farmhouse, and my grandmother has gotten holy water from the church up in Thibodaux, and she sprinkles us all and says, "Those snakes are not going to get you now, boys." So,
did you grow up having any superstitions or religious fears of snakes?
No, I love snakes. I early in my career, I wanted to be a herpetologist. I remember in eighth grade, I weighed about 82 pounds, and was 5'11", so I was a beanpole, so I was not a good athlete, but I knew all about snakes. My father had taught us all about snakes. He wouldn't let us go hunt snakes without knowledge. So, I'd bring snakes to school, and the girls thought this was cool. And I enjoyed my sort of tenure as, the snake charmer of the eighth grade class. There's a beautiful snake down there. I know people say, well, snakes aren't beautiful, but there's a snake called the mud snake, and it's brilliantly shiny black on the back and flaming red on the belly. And it grows quite large. It can grow up to about 7 or 8 feet, actually. And they're very, very rare. But its signature is that it has a vestigial horn at the end of its tail. And Cajun superstition held that if that snake stung an oak tree with its tail, the oak tree would die. And of course, we were collecting a few of these snakes, and they would prod you with this thing, but it was inept. It wouldn't hurt you, and they were actually quite docile snakes. But when people found out we had mud snakes, they were mortified. They just thought, you're just playing with fire, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Ken Wells. He's the features editor for Page One of the Wall Street Journal. He's also a novelist, and his new novel is called Junior's Leg. That and his previous novel are set in the bayou of Louisiana. What does it look like now in the part of the bayou where you grew up?
Well, it's a sad thing for me. There are still beautiful, beautiful pockets of Louisiana, and again, the Atchafalaya swamp water runs through my veins, and about the second thing I do when I get down there is get in a boat and go out on the bayou into the marsh or into the swamps. Usually I go fishing, but sometimes I just go looking, and there still are hauntingly beautiful places. And the truth is, the ecosystem down there, people don't quite realize this, from the Mississippi River to the Sabine River in Texas, rivals the Florida Everglades. You know, it just never got the press that the Everglades got. And of course, it's been also sort of bastardized by development. But one of the saddest things, to me, it was sort of a story of what was to come, but we squirrel hunted every season, and I haven't picked up a gun in 25 years. But I grew up in this family where my grandfather was a hunter and my father was a hunter, and squirrel hunting season to us was a ritual. Where we oiled up the guns and we shined up our hunting boots and we got the dogs ready, and it was always on the 1st of October, and the weather was always beautiful, and so I have these incredible memories. And you'd go at first light, and there would be fog in the top of the oak trees, and what I realized later is that what I really loved was being out there, whether we got squirrels or not, even though my granny made a really great squirrel dumpling, I have to tell you, if you ever had squirrel dumplings.
I have not.
But anyway, we would go out there. Well, there's this place that I hunted for probably 8 years going, and it was this beautiful, there was an old kind of slough that ran along the side of a cane field leading up to this big, beautiful ridge of oaks and then sort of tapering off into cypress swamp. And these trees must have been 200 years old, and they were just gorgeous. And I would just, every opening day, I would end up under those trees when the sun came up, And one year, I went back there, and they were putting in a subdivision, full of house trailers. And the guy who was doing it, had taken a D9 Caterpillar bulldozer and bulldozed down those trees to put in a sewage lagoon. And, I still haven't gotten over that. It's the kind of thing that it should have never happened. We should have had some modicum of zoning or planning. But, to me, it was sort of criminal, and we had this beautiful, beautiful place. And we just have not taken very good care of it, unfortunately.
My guest is Ken Wells. His new novel is called Junior's Leg. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Wells. He's features editor for Page One of the Wall Street Journal, and he's a novelist. His new novel is called Junior's Leg. His first novel was called Mealy LeBove. They're both set in the bayous of Louisiana. How did you go from snake catching to journalism?
Well, that's pretty hilarious. I'm an accidental journalist. I wanted to be what every boy who came of age around the 60s wanted to be, which is a rock star, And my brother had bought a guitar from Sears, and we were learning to play it. And I was in this failing rock band, and I was 19 years old. And I stepped aside from college, but I actually had flunked out of college. I was majoring in ping pong that semester. But anyway, I was desperate for a job, and I'm cruising the want ads of the little local weekly paper, and there's an ad saying part-time reporter wanted, apply in person. So I show up down there, and luckily, it was low pay and almost no standards. They were, I think it was $1.87 an hour, and are you willing to work 20 hours a week, and do you have a car? And then the last question was, let's see, Wells, now, would you be related to that guy, Catfish Willie Wells? And of course, that was my grandpa, Catfish Willie, as he was known in town. And, you know, it was one of those moments where it's kind of like a Clinton moment where, you know, what do you mean by grandpa? You know, because my grandfather was a character, you know, and you know, as I said, he was a really good fisherman and he was a really good drinker. And sometimes he would do both at the same time and get a real elevated opinion of his prowess. Well, the thing, it was the kind of little paper that, you know, he would catch these monster catfish. I'm serious. He one time caught a 52-pound flathead catfish on a cane pole in the middle of the town in a little place called off the Main Street Bridge. Well, anytime he caught a fish over 25 pounds, he'd ring up the newspaper and say, take my picture. And usually they would. And then if they didn't come promptly, you know, he'd drag the fish up the stairs and say, here I am. So here was a loaded question, you know, is that crazy old codger who drags these fish up our stairs your grandpa? And I said, well, he is my grandpa, he is. And John B. Gordon, who hired me and launched my career, bless his heart, said, you know, if you've got half the gumption of your grandpa, you can do this job. And so that was the beginning. My journalism career really is a fish story.
You know, there's so much about your life that is so different from mine growing up, you know, in New York. In the North, there's things that you've talked about that I have no comparable, you know, experience for. What was it like when you left the Bayou and started working in cities? I think you were in Miami and then in New York. Did you feel like a foreigner?
I often felt like a foreigner, and I still sometimes feel like a foreigner. And you know, my favorite joke is that, you know, I decided to write my novels one day when I looked around the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal and realized I was the only person who'd ever skinned a possum, you know. but the truth is, you know, one of the things for me, and I think it happens to a fair number of people who write, is that I had to get out of there to be able to write about it. You know, I was too close to it while I was there. You know, it didn't occur to me, honestly, Terry, when I was 19 years old that I'd had an interesting childhood. I mean, there are a lot of kids down there whose fathers were alligator hunters, you know, and frog hunters and commercial fishermen, and who, you know, made their living partly off the land. And, you know, I kind of took good time in Cajun culture for, you know, all culture. So I think it actually took me a number of years, you know, away from the Bayou before it occurred to me that, well, this is a strange place I grew up. And I think when I finally had kids, my oldest daughter now is 19 and my youngest one is 14. But I realized, because, you know, as you say, I lived in Miami, I lived in San Francisco, I lived in London, and we were living all over, and now New York. And I realized that they would not have, you know, their childhood was going to be nothing like mine. And in fact, it would be impossible to recreate it in a meaningful way, just because the Bayou has changed so much and we are now citizens of the globe and that sort of thing. So my first efforts to write about the place were really to sort of write down some of the stuff to give to my kids.
Well, you are features editor now for Page One of the Wall Street Journal, and the Wall Street Journal is famous, among other things, for its feature stories on Page One, which are usually a very colorful, often very odd, one-of-a-kind type of stories. What qualifies a story for placement on Page One in the Wall Street Journal?
Well, for one thing, we like to do things that are that are fresh and have not been done. So, you know, because we have a choice of the kinds of features. In other words, you know, for instance, the New York Times does great stuff, but they're almost obligated to do stuff that's always on the news a lot of the times. And we can often kind of take a step back, and since we're not the paper of record when it comes to features, we can be a lot choosier. I think that's one thing. I think you know the middle column of the front page is an institution, at least among journalism schools and journalism. You know, it's a story that we like to say floats off the page every day and is quirky. And the whole notion of that, it was actually invented in the 40s by our legendary managing editor, a guy named Barney Kilgore. And a stock column used to run there. And instead, he decided that our beleaguered business readers needed, you know, a break from that. And so started putting these kind of odd duck features. There was when I got to the San Francisco Bureau, there was a taciturn Texan named Ken Slocum, who was the Bureau chief, and there was a new reporter there. I joined at the same time as a woman named Carrie Dolan, and Slocum comes up to her and says, you know, Carrie, I bet there's a chance that a person could get in a car in San Francisco and drive clear across the country for the night in in a for the cost of a night in a fancy New York hotel, and that's $300, and you're going to do it. So Carrie Dolan had to get in a rental car and go across the country for under $300, and that became a legendary sort of feature story in the Wall Street Journal. They sent me off one time to Kodiak, Alaska, to do what? To cover a one-hole par 200 golf tournament up the side of a bear-infested mountain in the winter. You know, so you can tell that there's a slightly twisted sensibility that's at work here. And of course, we do very serious things too. You know, we do serious, I think, old-fashioned muckraking journalism as well, and you know. But altogether, you know, I think the whole notion is to try to always be lively, always be fresh, and try to always be ahead, which is what most papers are trying to do anyway.
Well, Ken Wells, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, this has been fun. Thanks for having me.
Ken Wells' new novel is called Junior's Leg. We recorded that interview a few days before September 11th, and we've been so caught up in covering the aftermath of the attacks that we haven't played the interview till now. The feature story on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal is about a class instructing shopping mall Santas how to answer kids' questions about terrorism. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.